Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left, Justice Bonnie Sutterth. I'm Leanne Dofano. Justice Sutterth was appointed to this court by the governor, and we are looking forward to working with her and to her positive contributions to this court. And I know you will enjoy working with her as much as we do. We have two cases set for oral submission on the 130 docket, and then we have two cases set on the 3 o'clock docket. We'll take a break in between the two dockets, even if we run over on the 130 docket, we're going to take a break. So y'all can just plan on that. All right, is there anything we need to do before we get started? Nope? Okay, I understand both sides are ready, so if you'll call the case.
The court will now call Fixin Today, LLC and Vanatech, LLC versus Santander Consumer USA, Incorporated. May it please the court. Mr. Jesse D. Hoffman will argue for the appellant. Mr. Donald L. Turnfield will argue for the appellant.
All right, thank you. Jesse?
Justices, for being here today to hear our case. May it please the court. This appeal is primarily about finding the appropriate measure of damages in a conversion case, which is essentially a dispute between two competing lien holders. In addition to that, it's about finding the level of evidence required in order to prove those damages. At the outset, the appellant Vanatech is asking this court to establish that appropriate measure of conversion damages in this sort of lien dispute, specifically asking, may a competing lien holder who has been awarded both possession of the vehicle, or I'm sorry, who has been awarded possession of the collateral, also be awarded the monetary value of that very same collateral? And we pose that the answer is a resounding no. That would result in a clear windfall, and it puts Santander in a far better position than it started in prior to the complaint. We actually have rules in place to prevent this sort of thing. The one satisfaction rule applies to prevent a plaintiff from obtaining more than one recovery for the very same injury. Now, Santander has suffered one injury. It suffered the loss of its collateral, and it's raised a whole range of claims for that loss, seeking both possession of the collateral and the fair market value of it. So Vanatech insisted on an election of remedies. In response, Santander claimed its entitlement to conversion damages, but it argued that conversion entitles it to both possession and the fair market value, and that's what we're challenging here today. There is a proper measure of damages for conversion, but it does not conceive of an award of both the property and payment for that very same property, so you have both its value and the ability to sell it and recover the same value all over again. The Texas Supreme Court holds that conversion damages are, quote, limited to the amount necessary to compensate the plaintiff for the actual losses or injuries sustained as a natural and proximate result of the defendant's conversion. That was from United Mobile Networks LP versus Deaton, decided by the Supreme Court in 1997. The actual loss or injury from conversion of collateral is an inability to foreclose on that collateral. You've lost your security for the loan it was securing. So the security for a loan really has no present value until such a default occurs, and in fact, it cannot even be exercised by the lien holder until that time. In this case, with one limited exception, there is no evidence that any of Santander's customers for these 15 disputed vehicles stopped paying their loans to Santander, and thus Santander could not have foreclosed on it. It never sacrificed any security because it never needed that security. In fact, when asked if his customers kept paying their loans after contracting with Vanatech, Santander's own corporate rep testified at trial, he assumes they did. He even says that one of those loans had already been paid in full prior to the date of trial. So if Santander has enjoyed the uninterrupted benefit of these loans, fully realizing the maximum benefit of them, then what damage was actually caused by a temporary loss? And I call it temporary because, as the evidence shows and throughout the testimony in this trial, the majority of these vehicles are available right now for return to Santander, or they can be made available. Vanatech would simply repurchase them from the entities that bought them. So I would pose that there is no benefit to Santander for recovering, or I'm sorry, there is no loss to Santander for not having had access to these vehicles because it never needed that security. Santander's only evidence, or I'm sorry, the, all right, so despite this lack of evidence of an actual damage to Santander, the court proceeded to erroneously calculate the fair market value of each of these vehicles, and it awarded damages based on that fair market value just up to the amounts owed on each individual loan to Santander. So in cases where fair market value has been the appropriate measure of conversion damages, the Supreme Court still requires evidence of, one, the fair market value of the property, two, at the time of conversion, and three, at the place of the alleged conversion. So it does have limitations, and it has a specific evidentiary requirement when you are proving fair market value. Santander's only evidence of the fair market value in this case were the purported NADA values. Now, these come from printouts that they produced at trial, which no witness could validate or even identify which variables were relevant to the valuations within those documents. NADA itself even cautions not to rely on its valuations without adjusting significantly for the vehicle's condition. The quote from their own website is, two different vehicles of the same model may have drastically varying prices depending on options, mileage, and overall condition. There was no evidence of any of those things presented at trial. There was no evidence of the time of the conversion presented at trial, and there was no evidence of the place of conversion at the time of trial. Similarly, we don't have evidence of those same things about the valuations presented on these purported NADA documents. So even if fair market value were the measure of damages, Santander has failed to prove that the unidentified third-party printouts it produced are actually appropriate evidence of those damages. And in fact, to the contrary, the evidence suggested that some of the vehicles were wildly overvalued by the court. So, for instance, the Bevins vehicle was valued by the court at over $18,000 based on these purported NADA values. That vehicle, according to the testimony at trial, had been totaled in an accident. It was cashed out by its insurer for $1,700. I mean, a fraction of the valuation actually assigned to it by the court. Another vehicle, the Salas Hosey vehicle, it was paid off entirely by the time of trial. Every one of these vehicles was in serious need of repairs whenever those customers entered a contract with Banatex. That's the service that Banatex provides. It finances repairs for people who just aren't going to pay for them up front. Moreover, Santander testified that it sells its collateral at auction value, not the clean retail values which these supposed NADA documents purport to provide. And I'll just clarify that in the NADA documents, they provide a range of values, and those values are supposed to be the clean retail value for a car that is ranging in its condition from very poor to excellent condition. So the trial court's estimation of fair market value, it does not represent an actual loss.
That was in the record.
I'm sorry, what was that?
That was in the record, the way they value the vehicles?
Judge, the way that the court valued the vehicles.
No, I mean, you said that it's the salvage value?
Oh, yes, that is in the record.
That is in the record, okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Santander's corporate representative testified to their method of selling off the vehicles after they're repossessed. He testified that they exclusively sell these at auction. These are extremely different values from what you would sell the same vehicle at a used car dealership for. And that variance is not accounted for, and there is no actual estimation of the fair market value as an auction value in this case. That evidence simply wasn't presented by Santander. All right, so I just want to emphasize that I don't believe fair market value is an appropriate measure of damages, but the evidence of fair market value is significantly lacking in this case. What I urge the court to find is that fair market value is not the appropriate measure. And in fact, the measure of damages needs to be tied to an actual estimation of damages suffered by Santander because of the loss of its security. In this case, that's nothing. They just need the vehicles back so that they aren't lacking security when they do need it.
How do they get the vehicles back if they've already been repossessed?
My client has the vehicles and it has actually been ordered to produce them back to Santander. They've been having some trouble actually getting Santander to accept the vehicles. and we've been unable to coordinate any kind of transfer like that.
So you repossessed them but held them, not sold them?
Yes, Judge. Because of the dispute, they were just put on hold and kept in the lot so that they would not be unavailable if they were needed. So that's the primary issue in this appeal. There are two other very important issues that I would like to address. One of them is the assignment of, the award of 100% of Santander's fees, despite the fact that they refused to segregate their fees. And I'm speaking of attorney's fees. It's already fairly clear, I believe, in prior court rulings and the precedent that this is simply unacceptable. The Supreme Court has held, we affirm the rule that if any attorney's fees relate solely to a claim for which such fees are unrecoverable, a claimant must segregate recoverable from unrecoverable fees. The court has even held that intertwined facts do not make tort fees recoverable. It is only when discrete legal services advance both a recoverable and unrecoverable claim that they are so intertwined that they need not be segregated. This is from Tony Guyo Motors, LP v. Chapa. It was a Texas Supreme Court case decided in 2006, and it modified the prior precedent on the same issue, which was from Sterling. I bring this up because the only relationship between these claims is that they arise from the same damage. And as the court has already held, those intertwined facts, that's insufficient. The claims have wildly different elements, and each claim had to be researched at least a little bit. Some portion of the work done by my opposing counsel was specifically dedicated to all of these other claims for which fees are not recoverable. Because of that, they're required by law to segregate their fees so the court can determine what portion of them should actually be awarded, if any. So we request that the case be remanded on that issue as well for a proper measure of attorney's fees to be decided based on segregated attorney fee evidence. The other important issue here is it's a question of joint enterprise. Now, in this case, the trial court inexplicably found that the appellant Fix-It Today will be held jointly liable with the appellant Banatex. Now, each of these contracts, these financing agreements, all of the repossessions, all of this was done by Banatex. Fix-It Today is a marketing company that does the marketing services and advertising services for Banatex. So they never should have been in this case to begin with. Now, neither the final judgment nor the findings and conclusions by the court actually identify the legal basis for extending liability to Fix-It Today. But I think I know what it is because the only such theory pleaded by Santander is civil conspiracy. So that must have been the basis. It's the only pleaded basis for extending liability to Fix-It Today. There was simply no evidence of a conspiracy in this case. There's precedent saying, quote, the essential element of conspiracy is the agreement to commit the crime. That quote comes from Hamilton v. State, which is an Amarillo appellate case in 2013, but the sentiment is echoed throughout our case law in every jurisdiction I've seen. The so-called crime in this case was Banatex's repossession of the vehicles pursuant to the financing agreement. It was a conversion. But Fix-It Today's only relationship to those activities was it provided marketing services to the entity that actually committed the alleged crime. So surveying all of the evidence in this case, the only factual depiction of what Fix-It Today actually does is to provide advertising, marketing services, and front-end processing or packaging. That comes from both trial testimony and from the deposition testimony from Fix-It Today. And there's no testimony that controverts that, none at all, or evidence of any kind. The advertising and marketing side of that involves advertising Banatex's debt purchase service to mechanics in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston. And it also advertises the related consumer financing service to potential customers for Banatex. The front-end processing or packaging side of this is just, they described it as, quote, getting Banatex's application documents back and forth between Banatex and its customers. So it's a fairly limited involvement in Banatex's business. Banatex runs its own shop. It simply hired out to have somebody get documents to its customers and advertise its service to them. I'll emphasize that this is called front-end, all of the provision of documents and the advertising, because it takes place prior to the actual financing. The nut meat of a Banatex transaction has nothing to do with Fix It Today at all. Once the application paperwork is submitted, Banatex steps in and it provides the actual financing agreement itself and goes through the final execution of those agreements. So Banatex pays Fix It Today an agreed fee for this service. It's clearly conceived of as a separate entity. It earns a separate fee and it's paid by Banatex. Moreover, Banatex is not Fix It Today's only client. So again, it's a very separate entity. Apart from Banatex, Fix It also it markets commercial loans as well as credit card terminals for several large distributors. It sells ACH services for a company called ACH Works. So Banatex is not just inextricably interwoven with Fix It Today. They are very separate entities with separate goals for their business. The trial court's own findings of fact acknowledge this. They identify Fix It's role as, quote, Fix It Today provides an advertising and marketing service to Banatex. The trial court then inexplicably finds that Banatex and Fix It Today are engaged in the business of making loans secured by motor vehicles for personal, family, or household use throughout the United States. The finding of fact simply does not support that conclusion of law. There's a massive gap between the two.
Your red light's on, so you're going to have to wrap it up.
Oh, yes. Well, that is, in fact, that's all I have to say on the issue, and I'm happy to take any questions if you'd like me to.
Any questions? Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
You go by Don or Donald?
Don.
All right, you're up.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent Appalachia Santander Consumer USA in this matter. This case, as briefed by the parties and as argued by the appellant in this case, is a case of first impression. The issue was presented to the trial court as to whether or not a possessory workers' lien created under Chapter 70 of the Texas Property Code could be assigned by a party who repaired a motor vehicle to a third-party lender who could then exercise the same rights as the holder of the statutory possessory lien, the workers' lien. Sometimes referred to as a mechanics lien, but it's a workers' lien under Chapter 70. Now, after the briefing in this case, the appellants withdrew their first issue on appeal. And that first issue involved the declaratory judgment relief awarded by the trial court, which found, in essence, that no, the possessory lien created under Chapter 70 of the property code cannot be assigned to a third-party lender, such as the appellants in this case. And it's interesting in the argument presented by the appellants that there's repeated comments about, well, this is a dispute between competing lien holders. It is not a dispute between competing lien holders. It is a dispute that's fundamental to a consumer credit transaction involving the finance of a motor vehicle. My client purchases retail installment contracts for car dealers, from car dealers, to provide purchase money financing for consumers and secures that credit transaction by notation on a Texas certificate of title. This case was precipitated by the appellant's misuse of Chapter 70, claiming that they had purchased a receivable from a car repair facility. And by purchase of that receivable, the benefits of the possessory lien inured to them, and that they could, by use of manipulation of either a blank check that they required of the consumer or an ACH transaction, make further use of Chapter 70's power of a workers' lien holder to repossess a motor vehicle. Because chapter...
If they've withdrawn that issue, why don't we just proceed on to damages, attorney's fees, and conspiracy, which is really all this court is going to be addressing?
I will do that, Your Honor. And had the argument not been made by the appellant that this was a competing lien holder claim, I would not make this argument in the manner in which I am. But the issue was briefed, withdrawn, and then argued.
Well, he made an allusion to it. I'll agree with you there, but that really wasn't the substance of his argument.
Well, then let's talk about the damages. I also want to remind the court that in terms of damages, my client is seeking damages as a secured party. These vehicles are owned not by my client, not by the appellants, but by consumers. They own these vehicles. My client's interest is in a measure of damages, the lesser of the value of the vehicle as collateral or the amount of the debt that it secures. That's a lien holder's, a contractual lien holder, secured party's measure of damages. Now, the evidence on those damages was presented to the court extensively. My client did provide testimony regarding the value of the vehicles and provided that in the form of NADA statements, with NADA providing a range of values, trade-in, rough trade-in, retail. But more importantly, the appellants in this case also had evidence of value, because although they argue that they were merely purchasing the debt from the repair shop, they did credit underwriting just as any lender would, even to the extent of providing in their own documents at the time that they extended this credit or purchased this receivable, however you want to call it, they provided in their own documentation evidence of value. So the trial court had, in making its determination, its award of damages, extensive information about damages and the value of those vehicles. The value that my client routinely would obtain by repossessing a motor vehicle and taking it to the auction is irrelevant, because it is the act of the appellants that was the act of conversion. And keep in mind, they repossessed these vehicles after they'd been repaired by these repair shops. So the issue regarding the Bevins vehicle about it being totaled, yeah, it was totaled, but it was totaled after they had converted it, after they had repossessed it. So at the point where the conversion took place, when the appellants repossessed it, there was ample evidence of damages, both from the appellants as well as from my client. So the evidence of damages is certainly sufficient to support the trial court's judgment. As to the attorney's fees.
Well, let me go back to that, the damages issue, because at least in his argument, his position was that your client had been paid in full for these vehicles and therefore suffered no damages when it was repossessed by his client.
That's an incorrect statement of the record.
Okay.
That's an incorrect statement of the record, because the record will reflect that there were payoff statements presented to the trial court that as of the date of trial, these were the amounts that were owed on these accounts. There was one account, and I think it was the Salas Hosey account, I believe, that was paid. But there's no conversion damages if there is no debt, because I would agree that the maximum recovery that a secured party can have from the conversion of its collateral is the lesser of the amount of debt it secures or the value of the collateral. So it is an incorrect statement of the record to say that there was a conversion damage where there was no consumer debt secured.
He also argued that the judgment gives you possession of the vehicles, correct? Awards you possession,
yes,
of the vehicles.
It does.
And he says he's tried to give you those vehicles and that you have refused to take them, or your client has refused to take them. I mean, I guess that's outside the record at this point, but...
It is outside the record, and there has been no official tender. And I think that the point that the argument by the appellant was, or we could get it back. Or we could get it. We either have it or we could get it back. I'm not quite sure exactly what this means in the context of somebody else who bought a vehicle from these people, what, 2 or 3 years ago now, and they're going to get it back. I'm not sure what that means in the context of this case.
I think it goes to conversion and the definition of conversion.
Well, they converted it when they repossessed it. If they sold it thereafter, that's not more or less of a conversion. They converted it when they repossessed our vehicle.
They said that, as I understood it, that they had the vehicles and all you had to do was pick them up, and you refused to do that. But if they have the vehicles and are offering them to you, it seems to me that would go to the conversion. You said you couldn't figure out why they were talking about that. I think they were talking about it because it goes to the conversion. And there are no damages if there's no conversion.
But there was a conversion. When they repossessed it, they converted it. If the vehicles were recovered the day after trial or the day after the judgment was entered, the judgment specifically provides that whatever money is received from the recovery of the vehicles, it's applied as a credit toward that judgment. That's why there's no double recovery here.
Well, but you were awarded possession, your client was awarded possession of the vehicles in the judgment, correct?
That's correct.
And you were also awarded a monetary sum.
That's correct.
And then it was stated in the judgment that if you sold any of those vehicles that you were awarded possession of, that would be a credit against the judgment amount that you were awarded.
That is correct.
Okay, so they're saying they've offered you the vehicles and you won't take them. So you're just pursuing the monetary judgment, I assume. Would that be correct?
Well, if you mean in the context of post-judgment collection efforts, we've not done anything. We had attempted a post-judgment garnishment, and it was vacated because of a post-trial motion, which is not briefed and is not for the record before this court. But these vehicles do not belong to my client. We have a lien on these vehicles. We have a right of possession, both through the judgment as well as through our security interest. The appellants in this case have no right of possession. And therefore, when they repossessed these vehicles, they converted them. I'd like to speak to the attorney's fees. The attorney's fees in this case were pursued by both parties under Chapter 70 of the Property Code, which has a specific provision for an award of attorney's fees involving a lien on a motor vehicle and a debt secured by that lien. Both parties pursued that. Both parties sought declaratory judgment relief. The Declaratory Judgments Act provides for recovery of attorney's fees, an equitable award of attorney's fees. The declaratory judgment action sought by my client was greater than just the 15 or so vehicles that were involved in this case. We wanted the court and obtained from the court a judgment declaring that there could not be an assignment of a possessory worker's lien to a third party such that that third party could then exercise those rights as if they were the worker. So we believe that we're fully entitled to those attorney's fees awarded by the court. There was testimony offered in the form of expert opinion as to the segregation issue. The Tony Gullo issue was addressed in an affidavit that I submitted to the trial court, and the trial court made that determination. So we believe that the attorney's fee award is entirely proper.
Well, now, you have, in this case, a conversion action, a theft liability action, and a DEC action, all of which do share common elements to prove and facts to support those elements. But then you've got a tortious interference with a contract that you pursued and a civil conspiracy. Now, those do not share common elements with conversion, theft liability, and the DEC action that you sought. So why shouldn't you segregate those out? You had to prove intentional interference with a contract, which is not related to the to the conversion, the DEC action, or the Theft Liability Act, and you had to prove for the tortious interference, and you had to prove a meeting of the minds and an intent to conspire that isn't shared by those other three causes of action. So shouldn't that have to be segregated out?
No. It all hinges on one primary point that the appellants brought to the trial court, that they had the right to exercise a statutory possessory lien in these vehicles. That's the common element. That is the common element.
That's one common element, but these other causes of action have different elements that some other causes of action don't share. And so you had to go down that rabbit trail, you had to conduct discovery, and you had to prove up those other, in fact, you got a recovery on civil conspiracy, so you had to prove up those elements, and those don't share the same facts as the other causes of action. So shouldn't that effort on your part for those causes of action on which attorney's fees are not recoverable be segregated out?
Based upon the Gullo case and the cases that follow, I believe that we provided sufficient opinion evidence to the trial court that segregation was not required. So I believe that it is not required in this case, that both the statutory awards under the property code, the declaratory judgments action, and the Texas Theft Liability Act, plus the fact that these elements are all fundamentally revolving around one basic concept, and that's the appellant's belief, their argument, their position, that they could acquire by assignment a possessory workers' lien in these vehicles. There would not have been a basis for a conversion claim if they had succeeded. There would not have been a basis for an award under the declaratory judgments action had they succeeded. When that one seminal issue was decided against them at the trial court, the rest of the issues fall into place. And that's the issue that they've withdrawn. I'd like to thank the court for its attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Jesse, do you have any rebuttal?
You have a very clear understanding of all the issues already. I just want to dispel a couple of things that I heard right there. The first thing I'd like to clarify is the judgment in this case was definitely based on the fair market values estimated in these sort of unproven NADA documents.
Came in without objection.
They did,
the NADA came in as a document on which the industry relies, that's a hearsay exception. There was no objection raised to their use, and therefore it's probative for all purposes under the hearsay rule.
Yes, and I understand. What I'd like to argue is simply that that's not the fight I picked in this case. I argue that the evidence is insufficient. It was admitted at trial. It is still insufficient for the same reason that it could have been found inadmissible at that time, and that's because no witness was able to actually tie this evidence to the vehicles at issue in this case. So they have extremely dubious relevance, and therefore that makes them insufficient as evidence, even though they were in. And the reason I bring them up specifically is because that was definitely the evidence that the fair market valuations from the judge were based on. If you compare the findings of fact to the NADA values, I mean, they're written verbatim from those third-party documents. One of the other things I'd like to clarify is that Banatex did not repossess and then wreck the Bevins vehicle. Mr. Bevins wrecked his own vehicle or somebody else. I don't know the circumstances, but it was not my client's. I think that might have been confused in some of the statements up here earlier. The one other thing that I will argue is that this was clearly a double recovery. The appellee has been awarded both the vehicles, possession of the vehicles, and payment for the value of the vehicles. The offset, I think he called it, that was described to you, this is not an actual offset. It's a discretionary election for Santander to take steps of its own accord that would basically take away its double recovery and limit it to just the one. They clearly are not going to do that. They have no incentive to do that, and the law doesn't allow them that opportunity. The one recovery rule requires the court to pick which one remedy it's going to award to the prevailing party. In this case, it did not. It simply awarded a double recovery for the same damages. I believe that sums up everything that I wanted to address, unless you all have any questions for me.
Any questions? All right. Thank you.
Very much.
We do appreciate your argument today, and appreciate you coming here to argue. You had a long way to come, and you had a tough way to come because our freeways are all either under construction or suffering wrecks for some reason. So we do appreciate your going to the trouble of coming here today to answer our questions. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, or if you want to stay around and hear the next case, you're certainly welcome to do so.